of the representation theorem that I gave you. Remember, the representation theorem tells you that that every CP map on density operators, which is a pretty good candidate for the most general admissible dynamical map on density operators, that every CP map can be represented as a unitary map on a larger system. Let me just give you something that you all know, and that's the Dilthoni theorem. And what we imagine is that there's some map that takes a system Q into two copies of itself, called Q1 and Q2. This is a little bit more general. It's between one kind of system and another, but I'll talk about that shortly. Assume that this guy always winds up in exactly the state that was set up in the original system. This one's perfect. What can you say, therefore, about the final state of the other system? So the Dilthoni theorem tells us that it can't be also a perfect copy of this for all input states. Let's see how that works out. What we know is that there's a unitary representation for this, and with a little work, you can come up with something like this. Here's the input Q. Here is, if you will, blank paper on which you're going to make your copy. Here's the environment. There's some big unitary transformation. By assumption, this original guy remains exactly the same. It's a perfect copy. And therefore, these guys are all in some sort of tensor product state, pure state, and these guys must also be in a tensor product state. There will be some final pure state of the second copy and the environment. Because this is unitary, the inner product between two distinct inputs will have to be the same as the inner product between the outputs, and that implies that the inner product between psi 1 and psi 2 is equal to the inner product between psi 1 and psi 2 times the inner product between phi 1 and phi 2. And if this is anything other than 0, not orthogonal, that means that these guys, this must be 1. And if we then throw away the environment, throw it away, and we're just left with this guy, that guy will either be in row 1 for one input, or row 2 for the other input, and those will have to be the same. So that tells us that in the original cloning procedure, this is not only terrible, it's in fact independent of the input. That this other copy, that this copy is perfect, this copy isn't, in a big way. This copy is independent of the input. So using our representation theorem, turning this into a unitary problem, and being assured that we've done things in very great generality, any reasonable map on density operators will satisfy this. Okay, so having mentioned this, because I want to use that later on, otherwise I wouldn't have bothered. Who needs another proof of it? I want to move to part two. So what's part two about? Well, it's about this whole universe as information networks, right? And the subsystems. They interact and exchange information. But here's the point I want to make now. Locality means that not all the subsystems of the universe exchange information directly. So that, say, these two guys right here, are connected indirectly, but they don't directly interact with each other. Not all parts of the universe are in direct dynamical contact. And as you can see, that's a really good thing. So the question I want to ask is, what does quantum mechanics say about the rules of this kind of web? And in particular, what does quantum mechanics say about this notion of locality, this notion of some subsystems cannot exchange information directly? All right. So, what I'm thinking about is something a bit more natural. So let's think about causal structure. Here's a picture of space-time for this slide only. Time goes up for all the rest of the slides. Time goes that way. Here are a couple of space-like hypersurfaces. And suppose I'm considering suppose I'm considering the some quantum field variables in a bounded region at a time t2. Then those variables depend on variables, the field variables in a larger region at time t1, but not everything. Not everything. In order to predict the future of this small region, I need to know the past of a somewhat larger region, but I don't need to know the past of the entire universe. That's good, because if you needed to know the past of the entire universe in order to predict the future, you wouldn't predict the future. So, this is a sort of a motivating picture. And there are other motivations. There's cellular automata and all kinds of interesting things, which I would skip. Oh, yeah, okay. That finishes up this. Okay, so what I have here is kind of like a bullseye, right? In the middle here, I've got the system of interest. And then I have this sort of surroundings. I have the rest of the world. It's very distant. This is place C. But in the middle, I have the surroundings of A that might contribute to the future state of A. It's the rest of A's neighborhood, if you will. The rest of A's neighborhood. From a causal point of view, though, I'm really going to think of this as a chain. I've got a system A, and it can interact with system B, and system B can interact with system C, but no information can be transferred from C to A. I'm going to have to answer the question we're all thinking. What does he mean? No information can be transferred. That's an important question to answer. But I'm going to say no information can be transferred from C to A. That's the thing I want to impose. So in some sense, I'm going to talk about information flow in a kind of negative way. I'm going to tell you what it means when there's not any. And then you can negate the definition and find out what it means when there is some. It's sort of like the famous line about pornography that the U.S. Supreme Court justice said. Couldn't define it, but he knows it when he sees it. Information flow is hard to define, but I know it when I don't see it. So, all right, information flow. Right, so what does it mean? What does it mean to say that information flows from C to A? What does it mean? What do I mean by that kind of very heuristic language? I mean, and this slide, of course, is I'll have you hold your objections to this slide, because of course this slide is very objectionable. This is the naive slide. You wouldn't have to include. Okay, to warn you. Okay. We can say that information flows from C to A if the final state of A depends on the initial state of C, and that information doesn't flow from C to A if the final state of A doesn't depend on the initial state of C. And that might be all very well. Oh, and when I say it doesn't depend on it, I'm going to consider all possible initial states of this system of A and C. All the possible initial states. And then I'll ask, does the final state depend on the initial state of that? Because of course, you're at the Quantum Foundation Summer School. So you know what the problem is here. You know that this is a very problematic sort of statement. Because the initial state of A and C, for that matter, the final state of A and C, isn't determined by initial states of A and C separately, but there could be entanglement. And what does that mean? How does that fit in with all of this? Yeah, that would be better. We can actually record it. So let's think about two bits. Let's think about two bits. Two classical bits. And one of the interactions of these two bits, which you've seen here, it's a sort of a paradigm for lots of things, is the controlled knock. So we've got two bits. There's C, the control bit, T, the target bit. And we sort of draw it in this way. And what happens is that the control bit is unchanged in the operation. And the target bit is flipped, provided the control bit is 1. And otherwise, the target bit is unchanged. Okay. So it's a really simple sort of thing. There are lots of good things about the control knot operation. You can write it down very easily. You can note that it's reversible. The operation is reversible. In fact, if you apply the C knot again, you can get identity. So, so this is a kind of a nice operation on a pair of qubits, a pair of bits, excuse me. We're not the qubits yet. And the final state of the target does depend on the initial state of the control. Crucially depends on it. So there is information flow from the control to the target, but the final control bit is exactly the same as the initial control bit, no matter what the target bit is. So there is no information flow from the target to the control. So in this system, there's one-way information flow. Information flow only goes one way. It goes from the control to the target at maximum. Okay? Classical CNOT has one-way information flow, according to our sort of previous heuristics. What about the quantum version of that? Well, what we have is a couple of qubits. There's an interaction. It's a unitary interaction. Once again, we have a control and target qubit. And I'll tell you how this product of basis maps under the evolution. And they map exactly according to the classical map on bit values. Okay? It's just on the standard basis states, the quantum CNOT is the classical CNOT. But I also let this work on superpositions. So I make this into a unitary operation. What happens then? Well, is there one-way information flow? And the answer is no. There's not. It looks like there might be, but it's because, you know, it's doing the same thing classical CNOT did. But look at the CNOT in a conjugate basis. Look at how it acts on input states, which are products of plus and minus. Well, then, if you work it out, and if you want to, this is homework number three. But I'm not going to give any more. If you look at the control and target bits, plus plus goes to plus plus, and plus minus goes to minus minus, and so on. If you look at this, you'll say, wait a second. For these basis states, the target bit state is unchanged. And the control bit is flipped, provided that the target is in minus rather than plus. In other words, in the conjugate basis, the control and target bit have switched roles. Which one is the control and which one is the target depends on what basis you want to use to describe the system. And there are other bases where neither one of them is particularly a control bit. So, quantum mechanically, a CNOT going this way is pretty much the same as a CNOT going that way, just in a different basis. So, yeah.
I'm not supposed to take that literally.
Literally? No, this is not literally. No. Of course, there would be little unitary operators here to conjugate things in different ways. But from the point of view of information flow, this is the same kind of thing as that. I could quotation marks around. That would seem kind of weird in pictures. So there's no one-way information flow in the quantum CNOT. That's very curious. And in fact, there's no unitary interaction between a pair of quantum systems, which leads to one-way information flow. You can't make a unitary interaction between a pair of quantum systems so that the state of one system can sometimes affect the state of the other system in the end, but the reverse can't happen. Yes?
Is that not exactly the same as the no-quantum theorem?
Is that not exactly the same as a no-quantum theorem? The exact identity between this and the no-quantum theorem is not obvious to me, but it might indeed be might indeed be the same thing. I don't know. Only information. It's a little bit different because when we talk about cloning machines, we're allowed to have certain inputs be in standard fixed states. Whereas, here, we're allowing ourselves to, we have to make ourselves check all of the possible input states. So, that's a different situation. The quantifiers are different. Okay?
It's isomorphic to the nonproduct.
I wouldn't even say that. Perhaps, but I don't know. Okay, this is the world's most trivial quantum measurement model, as you know. C is the system of interest, the thing out in the world there that we want to measure. T is our measuring apparatus, and we set this up so that what we like is we like the system of interest to flow some information, send some information over to the measuring apparatus without going back, because we don't want to do anything to the system of interest, and sorry, that just won't work. Any unitary interaction is going to allow information flow either way. And if you chase this down, you can maybe convince yourself that this is what this complementarity thing is all about. So maybe it's the secret of the universe, but it might be a trivial observation. So, not that those two are mutually exclusive. Yes, Rob.
Do you think this is similar to the action-reaction principle?
When I've talked about this before, I have described it in this way. It's like Newton's third law, action reaction. However, at the level I'm talking about, I'm not really quantifying how much there is, and so I don't address the question of, is the capacity this way, the same as the capacity that way. You can address these questions, get really interesting answers, but I'm just saying, is there or isn't there? And it's not quite as refined as Newton's third law, which says the forces are equal, not just there is a force, but the forces are equal and opposite.
Wouldn't you expect that if a certain amount of information flows one way, then the same amount of information needs to be flowing back?
I'm just thinking about that. What's the status on that? I can only remember the things about general operations. Yes, Dave.
I think between three gates, the forward and the backward communication rate can be very, very different.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't recall that they had to be equal. So, but the unitary gates, it could be very different.
Well, you have one qubit and another qubit in Russian
gate,
not in general.
Okay. Well, another situation where qubits are misleading. Yeah, okay. If you try to do the same thing about generalized quantum operations, you can imagine some CP map on the two of them. Indeed, you can have one-way information flow for general CP maps. For example, you could make a measurement on this bit. You could use the output of the measurement to choose a unitary transformation on this guy. Overall process would be described by a CP map, but the final state of this guy would not depend at all on what the initial state of the target would be. And so this is an example that does have one-way information flow in a more general kind of operation. There's more to say to that sort. Okay. I want to just do something which I've already done a little bit. In general, we can have CP maps between states of different systems. And what's going to really interest us we have an initial state of a composite system, and we're looking at the final state of a subsystem of that system. And the partial trace operation, for example, is such a CP map. You have a big system, you take the partial trace, you get a state of a smaller system. So the way we're going to write it is we're going to have superscripts and subscripts. The superscripts being the output system. The subscripts being the input system. And so here, you can imagine we have a joint system R and Q, the composite system, and then something happens, and we're only looking at the final state of Q. So these things are possible, and it's also possible to have a final system larger than the initial system, which is what happened when I first drew the scheme for the cloning machine. Okay, I've been playing a little fast and loose with the idea of what I mean about information transfer. I say when is there no information transfer between one system and another? I'm going to phrase this in terms of locality. Once again, we have this this trio of systems, and we have a global evolution on all three of them, which may or may not be unitary. A global evolution on all three of these guys. And the question is, what does it mean to say that no information flows from C to A? Remember, that's what we meant by locality. C was the distant universe, B was the neighborhood, A was the system of interest. What does it mean to say that the distant universe doesn't affect the future state of the system of interest? That there's no information flow. And so my colleague and I sat around for a couple of days and tried to think of all the different things it could mean. And it sort of boiled down to three definitions. So here's definition number one. Definition number one says that, okay, it means that if I know the initial AB state, that's enough to find out the final A state. That there's a CP map taking initial AB states to final A states. This thing exists. Okay, that's definition number one, that there is such a map, that I can find. To find the final A state, all I need is the initial A, B state. I don't need the global state of the whole system. Definition number two, it is a little bit more like the class, an attempt to fix up some sort of classical definition. They say, well, suppose this starts out in a product of pure states. Suppose the system starts out in a product of pure states, and then I apply the global evolution, then I would say that there's no information flow if the final state of A doesn't depend on what the pure state that C had was. This is a situation where it makes sense to talk about the initial state of C by itself. And in that situation, this is my definition. And the third definition is, okay, this is a little better. So suppose this is just in any initial state whatsoever. And suppose somebody comes in and performs some operation on C. Okay? Maybe one of two possible operations. And then the evolution occurs, and afterwards, A is in some state. Then I say there's no information transfer from C to A, provided that the final A state doesn't depend on which operation was initially performed on C. And that's for any initial state of the system. Okay, yeah?
So I'm seeing a strong analogy between at least definitions one and two, possibly three, and Bell's original paper, he defined locality. I'm thinking of Caddis Morse's paper, Bell's paper. It just seems like we're just dressing up locality in this new language, saying it's information flow, and I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
This is a form of locality that is suitable to quantum states rather than to any notional hidden variable theory.
Well, okay. No, I mean, Bell's paper, of course, isn't about hidden variable theory.
Right.
About locality in general,
okay.
And we violate those inequalities.
I mean, well, great. there may well be a connection, and if there is, then you already know the upshot of this, which is that all three of these are actually the same definition.
Right.
They're equivalent to each other, and that's really easy to see. It's pretty clear that one implies two. Is that right? Which one's which? Oh, no, sorry. Three implies one. Three implies one, that's pretty easy. No, let's see. I forgot which way it goes around.
One, two, three, two.
Okay. One implies three, obviously, because if there's a CP map from initial B states to final A states, those initial AB states, the final A states, the initial AB states will not be affected by any operation on C. Okay? So one certainly implies three. I don't know what I said before, but that's true. One certainly implies three. Three also certainly implies two, because I could change my choice of a C state by an operation that just resets the state to whatever I like. And if it doesn't depend on the operation, it doesn't depend on the on the initial C state. And it's also true, though a little harder to prove, that 2 implies 1, because basically you can make the density operators out of these guys and find enough of them to form a basis for all operators, and that turns out to be enough to guarantee the existence of this matter. Yeah?
Can you just say that again? You said 1 implies 3?
One implies 3.
And then 3 implies 2?
3 implies 2. Those are both easy. This is true because if this map exists, then any change will commute with any operation on C, and therefore any operation on C won't do it. This one implies this because these are all possible initial states of A, B, C, and there are operations that simply reset the state of C, and so I could realize this condition in this way. And the tricky one is to go from here to here. It's just about a half a page of work using the fact that you can make an operator basis of things that are density operators of those guys. So these are all the same. They're all equivalent. That made us feel good. Now, all the things we thought of are really the same definition. There's really one idea here, not a whole family of ideas that you have to distinguish and so on. Yeah, Rob.
So this may be cheating because I'm asking you about where you're going to go. But none of these are testable conditions, right? They're all... there does not exist, or there does exist, sort of things.
They're exactly as testable as any physical hypothesis. Because if I say this exists, that means that I can write down a map like this that will allow me to make statistical predictions about A reliably based on information only about A and B.
But given E, A, B, C, right, the channel.
Yeah.
I want some algorithm that I can plug into my computer that will tell me whether or not there is information flow from C to A. And my computer, how does my computer know how to search over all possible EABAs to see whether one exists that does this? So I'm curious whether there's a sort of algorithmic testable condition that you're going to...
I should have known. You would ask me this question. An algorithmically testable one, you don't have to do for all pure states. It suffices to do a set that gives you an operator basis for each one. V squared, all V to the sixth combination, for example.
Okay.
There may be a similar simplification elsewhere, but that one is finitely computable.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay. So let's consider what happens when we have global unitarity. In other words, suppose we have A, B, and C evolving unitarily, but all three of them, but there's no information transfer from C to A. Can that happen? Remember, we've got a somewhat more complicated system than we had before. Instead of having two systems interacting unitarily, we have three. And can we have it so that they all interact unitarily, but no information is transferred from C to A? But maybe information is transferred from A to C. What can happen? Well, the answer is sure, that can happen. There are some trivial cases. One would be that either A or C were isolated. So you could have, C and B interact with each other, and A does its own thing. Or you could have that C does its own thing and A and B interact with each other. And in either case, there's no information transferred from A to C. Those are trivial. Also reasonably trivial would be the case where B was a composite system and A and C interacted with separate parts of C, or of B, separate parts of the middle system. And then there would be no information flow from one to the other. Those are trivial cases. But there's something more interesting. A more interesting example would be something like this. First, A and B interact unitarily, and then B and C interact unitarily. Points to note. You've got an A-B interaction followed by a B-C interaction. And there could be one-way information transfer in this. Because you could have the initial state of A causally affect the final state of C in this way. This would be okay. That would work. That could happen. But on the other hand, that's not okay. That's not okay because it's going backwards in time. Some other talk, maybe we can play games and go backwards in time, but No, not today. So this can't happen. So C cannot affect A, but A can affect C. This is interesting. When you have an intermediate system, there's the possibility of one-way information transfer between the ends. And this is pretty good. The previous examples, the trivial examples, can all be converted into something of this form, this general form. And here's the good thing. The good thing is, this is the only possibility. This is the only way it can happen. Yeah?
Is special relativity important? I mean, similar to that.
Special relativity is, the purpose of this talk, only a motivating principle. And if you saw that light cone structure that I drew to motivate the idea that the state of part of the universe only depends on the previous state of some larger part, but not everything. And there's this causal structure given by the light cone. But in fact, beyond that, I'm not really using special relativity, though I would be loath to say it's not important.
I mean, I'm just in this example, if you could find a frame of reference where these events switched order, then it would look like the information goes the other way.
Presumably these guys right here are following non-space-like paths, and so you couldn't really switch the order because the order would be determined in every frame of reference. These things are like particles, big heavy things like that. Then these are timeline lines. Okay, and so these events are the before these events in every frame. Yeah. Okay, so I say this is the only possibility, by which I mean, in the theorem, suppose we have a system A, B, and C that evolves by a unitary U, A, B, C, such that no information transfer is possible from C to A, according to any of the definitions before. Then you can always write that unitary operator as a product of, first, a unitary transformation acting only on A, B, followed by unitary transformation acting only on B, C. Of course, since we read from, since you have to read these operators from left to right, they appear in the opposite order right here. But it's the same order in time. So first, these guys interact, then these guys interact. Once again, I'm not claiming this is actually what happened. What I'm saying is that this is effectively what happened. Mathematically, I could decompose. I could always achieve this by first doing this and then doing this. Maybe something much more complicated happened, but it could always be decomposed in this way. Okay, so how do you prove this? Well, it has some details. So let me just take a couple of transparencies to sort of tell you the flavor of the proof without really doing it. But I'll give you a reference at the end. So that'll be good. Okay, so how it works. So you've got this unitary interaction here. But because there's no information flow from C to A, this thing induces this CP map taking initial AB states and giving me final A states. Okay? This thing yields that. So let's take a look at this thing. That was easier to put this thing. Let's take a look at that thing. Okay. Some of the outputs of this guy are pure states. There may be pure state outputs. And it turns out, this is kind of an interesting fact. Homework problem number four. That's the last one, I promise. It turns out that for every pure possible output state, there's a subspace of pure input states that map to it. In the following sense, the subspace is defined as the set of vectors in the Hilbert space such that the operation, this is on the Hilbert space of AB, the operation acting on this guy is some constant times the projection onto this guy. The constant is so that you can have big vectors and little vectors and a zero vector. As long as there's something like this, and this is in the subspace, and the instant thing, the homework problem is to prove that this is a subspace in general. It might be the null space. It might be that nothing maps to this pure state. It might be some other subspace, but it is a subspace. A subspace of the underlying Hilbert space. That's cool. And very handy. So every output state has a precursor subspace. And it turns out that in this situation, where you get this from a big unitary like that, it turns out you can show that each precursor subspace for all the different possible pure outputs have exactly the same dimension. And that dimension is the dimension of the Hilbert space for B. Every one of these guys has exactly the same dimension. So it's like, for any A state, it's like a subspace in the Hilbert space for AB. For every A state, there's a subspace of dimension of a Hilbert space for B in that Hilbert space for AB. And it turns out, is this a question? Or
yes,
is
the question is, it can be the null subspace.
It can be the null subspace, except in this case, where this thing is derived from a unitary like that, it isn't ever the null space. They're all of this dimension. In a general map, it could be the null space. But in this case, they're all the same dimension. We call that the uniform dimension condition, so we're very happy to find it, because we need a good name for it. So this is pretty interesting. Each precursor subspace is the same dimension. So think about what you've got. For every A state, there's this subspace. And you can put these all together, and it turns out that you can use this to construct a tensor product structure. A tensor product structure that lives in the Hilbert space for A and B. A tensor product structure that the space looks like all the A states tensored with copies of the B states. But you say, well, of course it's a tensor product structure. It's a composite system. But this tensor product structure isn't the same as that tensor product structure. It's different. It's been twisted by a unitary operator. Okay? So at this point, this is the point of maximum confusion. So what about that? There's a unitary transformation, I'll call it the dagger. Realizing later on I don't want the dagger. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is this. What it means is that if I take that tensor product structure that I built out of that operation, that tensor product structure that's not just this tensor product structure, and I apply V to this thing, then it becomes the tensor product structure having to do with the subspaces. The fact that this and this are put together in a tensor product filter space is just that structure that I built painstakingly by looking at precursor subspaces. Okay? So it's exactly the subsystem structure. If I first take A, B, and C and then apply operation V to the result. Now, because of the way I built those precursor spaces, it now turns out that after, if I take some initial state here, after V acts, the system A is in exactly the right output state for the operation. But B and C aren't. But because they are purifications of the right output state for A, there's always a unitary transformation that can go from one to the other. In fact, it's always the same unitary transformation. It turns out I can fix it up by including a unitary W acting on BC only, and there I have the decomposition. Yeah. If this is a unitary interaction of all three, and there's no information flow from C to A, then there is always a non-null precursor subspace for any output pure state of A. Another lemma that you prove along the way.
Is it difficult?
Is it difficult? No, that one was pretty easy. So let's see. It's in the paper. I want to go ahead and get to the end, but we can talk about that afterwards. It's really not too hard. I hate doing that. Okay, so that's how the decomposition works. And this decomposition for this set of three systems can actually be used to leverage your way into a whole bunch of other deep theories. And so let me just tell you what those are. Here's the first one. Suppose we've got a general CP map on two systems, just A and C, okay? Such that no information in this general CP map, no information goes from C to A, but maybe information goes from A to C. Then I can show that there's a unitary representation of this form. That I've got an environment, first the environment interacts with A, then the environment interacts with C, then you throw the environment away. But there's a unitary representation of the map on AC that looks like this. And actually, this is a previous result. This is sometimes the statement is sometimes said goes by this great phrase: semi-causal operations are semi-localizable. And these references will be at the end also. But it's a quick corollary of the previous decomposition theorem. Another interesting question is, what about things in general? Suppose I've got A, B, and C, and I've got some general CP map. I don't have global unitarity anymore. Now the whole system may be affected by a noisy environment. And all kinds of terrible things may happen. I've got a general CP map. And suppose no information is transferred from C to A. Maybe A to C, but none from C to A. Is it true? Can we always decompose a map in this way, so that first I have a general CP map on B, and then a general CP map on B and A, and then a general CP map on B and C? Is that true? Yes.
What are those symbols?
Those are supposed to be a script F and a script G, but I had to turn the resolution on my monitor way down, so this is as good as it gets. Okay? Script F and script G. And the answer is, actually, there is no such decomposition theorem. There are local maps, that is to say things that don't have information from C to A, that are not of this form. However, we can say something. If we have this setup, then I can say there's always a unitary representation for the general map that's of this form, where first A, B, and the environment interact, and second B, C, and the environment interact. Now, how is this different from the previous decomposition? It's exactly the point that was made last hour. After these guys interact, there may be entanglement, there may be correlations between E and B. So this unitary operation isn't really a CP map on BC, because there are pre-existing correlations, perhaps, with the system B. So this isn't quite what we had before, but it's got some of the flavor. First, A, B, and the environment do things. Then B, C, and the environment do things. And then you discard the environment. And all CP maps with this locality condition can be decomposed in this way. Questions? I think it's time to press the speed up button here. I'm going to skip the next few things. Though it's very interesting. It's just, showing off stuff, so. Okay. I want to get to the interesting thing here at the end and finish on time. So I want to talk about our friend the CNOT gate. And we usually use CNOT as a little component in our big quantum computation algorithms. But what I want to do is I want to take that little component and I want to take it apart into pieces. I want to dissect it. I want to see what's going on inside. In particular, we know that in the CNOT gate, information flow goes both ways. That information goes from here to there, and other information goes from there to here. It's a two-way information flow. So what I want to know is whether I can model this in a particular way. What I want to do is I want to give it sort of an explicit picture of this two-way information flow. I'll see if I can do that. What's the structure of the information flow inside CNOT? I'm really splitting the atom here. So here's the model that we're going to check out. The model is what we might call simple information exchange. I've got a couple of systems, and then what happens is that each of these systems individually undergoes some evolution, which might be general CP map. And there are two outputs. In fact, it probably is a general CP map. I've got two outputs. I've got two outputs here. One of them stays on this side, and the other one crosses over. Independently, this guy undergoes a general map here. And then the output crosses over here. And then finally, these pieces are locally put back together, and the output comes out. And the question is, can I make CNOT this way? And one of the reasons I think I might be able to is because every classical gate could be modeled in this way. Every classical gate on two inputs with two outputs could be done this way. What you do is you go in here, and then you make a perfect copy of the information at the bottom in two copies, send one of them over here, do the same thing up here, and then these guys have exactly what they need to produce the outputs. Of course, there was that dangerous word, copying. And you might expect that might be a problem, quantum mechanics. And the answer is, the answer to this question, can CNOT be modeled by local CP maps and simple information exchange like this? And the answer is, no, it can't. And it's simple enough that I'll just write on the board here. Okay. All right, this is pretty easy. But just to be sure. So what have I got? I've got this I want it to wind up being this. And what have I got? I've got this. And I've got a bunch of CP maps here. I'm going to write them all as E, even though they might all be different. Okay, so let's and this is the control bit, and this is the target bit. Let's imagine that we fix the input state of the control bit to be zero, and we try various input states here. Okay, and let's just look at what happens to the bottom here. In the bottom, we have psi going in, and then something comes along, something goes off, something else happens. This has got an input, but the input is fixed. The input of this guy is fixed. It's always the same. So we can just sort of fold that into this map. And the output, what happens when the control bit is zero is that this guy has to be the same coming out. That doesn't matter. That has to be the same coming out. Which means that this is just like that diagram I drew for the no-quantum theorem. Which means that this must have no correlation whatsoever with the input state here. This wire, if you will, carries no data at all about what the input state is down here. Of course, that's a problem, You know, you can do the same thing on the top guy, except let this guy be plus, and this guy be 5. If this guy is plus, what the so-called target is plus, well, we're thinking in the conjugate basis, this is the control, and this is the target. The same argument says that this wire carries no information whatsoever about the top qubit, which means that the output over here cannot depend on the input here, and the output over here cannot depend on the input over here, but we know that's not true. We know that C0, that certainly does happen. The outputs do depend on the other inputs. And so that means that this diagram cannot possibly achieve C0. Okay. In fact, a colleague of mine, Michael Nathanson, who's now at St. Mary's College, has shown that, that what's true for C0 is also true for a wider class of gates. He says no entangling unitary two-qubit gate can be modeled by a local CP maps and simple information exchange in this way. By entangling, I mean something that for some product state inputs will lead to an entangled output. The swap operation can be used to generate entanglement between parties, but that doesn't lead to a product. Swap means you just take big qubits and trade places. That's not an entangling gate in this situation. The swap gate can certainly be done in this way. Now, this is kind of cool. It leads to the conjecture that maybe this is true for things beyond qubits, and the answer is it's not true for things beyond qubits. Qubits, once again, are misleading. There are things which are entangling that can be done in this way, and there are also things that can't be done in this way, and we really don't know what the characterization is in general. So if you need something to argue about over beer at pub night, or if you need homework problem number 5, characterize what two system gates can be modeled in this way, in general. That's a sort of a research problem. Now, the funny thing is there are lots of really interesting ways you can make C0. For example, you can do it this way. This is pretty easy, where first you have the information go one way, and then you have the information go back the other way. That's really easy. What you do is you just send this qubit over there, and you do your C0, and you bring it back over here. Okay? No problem. Another way to do it, and this is kind of cool, is suppose you have an entangled pair of qubits. Okay? Then you can do an exchange like this, where there's an operation here, an operation here, an operation here, an operation here. And in between, you exchange these guys, and afterwards, you get back the entangled pair that you had before. You didn't use it up. It didn't cost you anything. You just had to invest it a little bit. And then you can do C0. In fact, I'll tell you how to do that, just in case you want problem 6. This is not even a problem, so I'm going to tell you the answer. What you do is you have the state 0, 0, plus 1, 1. I suppose it's normalized too. Okay, and you split it up to these guys. Boy, that's really awful. Okay? Oh, sorry, I have to exchange them, don't I? It won't work otherwise. Okay. So the question is, what operations do you do here, 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 and here, and the cute thing is, they're all C0s. And at the end of the day, the middle has been restored to the original state, and you've accomplished the C0 operation on the outside guys. So my question is, what is the fundamental difference between an information flow pattern like this and an information flow pattern like that? What is it that this quantum interaction is getting at? What is it really telling me? What's the sort of topological difference that makes this guy not able to do an operation like CNOT, but these guys can. In fact, this guy can do any operation. I don't know about this guy. I haven't thought about it. Good question. How many problems have I? Okay, so that's what's the essential difference between these information flow patterns and simple information exchange. Here are some references. I've got quantification numbers for all of them, so you scribble those down. The theorem that I talked about this time is in this guy right here. This talks about related things with reversible quantum cellular automata. This is kind of a very similar set of considerations growing out of quantum gravity. These are the two papers that work on that two-system result about semi-causal and semi-localized cooperation. And with that, I am done. Thank you very much.